a bill to block many COVID restrictions, a harder ballot access hurdle for libertarians, plus changes to the State Board of Education, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 29th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, an Indiana lawmaker wants to ban state and local governments from ever again imposing many of the restrictions in place over the course of the last year. Republican Representative Bob Morris's legislation would ban state and local governments from limiting a business's hours of operation or occupancy, regulating what procedures hospitals can do, and requiring mask wearing or social distancing in a church unless those things are already in state or federal law. All of those are executive orders Governor Eric Holcomb has issued during the pandemic. Joseph Cerruti runs a catering company in Fort Wayne that he says has been decimated by Holcomb's restrictions.
So many inconsistencies with these rules. They're arbitrary. They don't accomplish the goal.
As an example, Cerruti says it doesn't make sense that a restaurant in his county can be at full capacity while he's only allowed to hold events of 25 people or less in his much larger banquet halls. The bill also says local health officials can't close private schools and churches in order to prevent and stop epidemics. A House committee heard the measure Monday but did not vote on it. During the hearing, Morris questioned whether mask wearing was effective in preventing the spread of COVID-19. In reality, experts agree that wearing a mask can help prevent the virus's spread and may even help reduce the severity of the illness when infected. Should governments be reined in when it comes to these restrictions in the future? Excuse me. It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, is this an overreaction to COVID or an appropriate handcuff to government authority?
I think it's both. I don't think Bob Morris is the resident mask expert in the Indiana General Assembly on one hand, but on the other hand, I think he's reflecting what is a real frustration, and I think what we've seen in the last week with some changes in policy, one that's been legitimized, and that is you may have a caterer who has a large banquet facility who's shut down, but you've got a fast food restaurant down the street that can stay open. You've got a cabinet maker, in a small town in Indiana that is forced to close, but the Lowe's, in the next town over can be open with hundreds of people in it. I think those are the kind of inequities that I think are driving the frustration that you're seeing reveal itself in some of the legislation that's been introduced and the tone of the General Assembly on this topic up to this point. They're reflecting the frustration of Hoosiers from around the state. They're trying to find the balance on what's right and what isn't. I think Governor Holcomb moving from a kind of a strict capacity number to a percent of capacity, as an example, is a common sense way to try to accommodate those issues so more people can stay open, but stay open safely. And I think we're getting some things right now that we got wrong to begin with, and that just led to a lot of frustration amongst especially small business owners in Indiana.
And Delaney, Mike O'Brien just kind of laid out some of those inconsistencies in these restrictions that we've seen play out over the last 10 months. Is this sort of route that Bob Morris is taking the right way to address those sorts of inconsistencies?
No, it's not. I mean, what Bob Morris is saying is that the governor failed in dealing with COVID, which is kind of striking coming from a fellow Republican. There's no good way. There's no one size fits all for this. Mike's right about that. We have to give some thought to some of these variations. It came on so fast. And part of the inconsistency, of course, came from Washington when you had Donald Trump telling people that only sissies wear masks and on and on and on. So, I mean, there were lots of false steps in this. I had one criticism of Governor Holcomb is that he lessened the restrictions too soon. Now, nobody tried to hurt the caterer in Allen County that's obviously Bob Morris's buddy. But the fact remains that people did get hurt with this. A lot of people got hurt with this. But it's a national and certainly a statewide crisis. And I guess he would rather see or be willing to see more people die than anybody inconvenienced or business put in some kind of a box. And maybe what he should be saying is, why isn't Governor Holcomb handing out the money that the federal government gave him to help these businesses who had to close because of this. But the idea that the General Assembly could adapt a law that and could do it in the time frame that's necessary when we're facing a national pandemic is ridiculous. The governor has to have the power.
Nikki Kelly, we've seen sort of two methods of reining in the governor's emergency power, at least discussed and brought up so far in the General Assembly session. One, Representative Matt Lehman's bill would just sort of give the General Assembly the opportunity to have its own say in a future sort of long-lasting emergency situation. The others, like Representative Morris's, like some we've seen in the on the Senate side, gets more to the nitty-gritty of what the government can do, not how it can do it. Talking to legislative leaders here at the end of this week, did we get any sort of sense of which way they want to go?
Well, they didn't really criticize Bob Morris's, you know, bill, but they did focus more on the other way, on focusing. I guess I would compare it in terms of sort of the big picture bills of the macro, how long an emergency can go before the General Assembly weighs in, versus the sort of micro bill that, you know, sort of micromanages each individual decision. And so this bill basically takes five or six decisions that they didn't like and say that they can't do them in the future. I think the problem is that this emergency law applies to a lot more emergencies than just a COVID-19 pandemic, you know? And so I do think there are probably some unintended consequences we're not thinking through to whether, you know, what if there's a tornado or a hurricane or a nuclear fallout, you know, all those things could be impacted by that.
John Schwanes, I want to talk for a second about what Bob Morris said during that committee hearing, which is that we don't know that masks work. Well, we do. But when asked about those comments, Speaker Todd Houston this week didn't address them. He just said that, you know, he believes he's preached mask wearing. He believes the science is there to suggest that mask wearing works, and he'd leave it at that. Is that a strong enough response from the leader of the House?
One could argue it's not strong enough, but keep in mind that no matter how strenuous the comments are or the rebuke might be from the Speaker of the House, it's not going to change the opinions of some members of his caucus who have made abundantly clear that they are not supportive of any mask mandates. And beyond not being supportive of mandates, they don't think it behooves them to wear masks, whether or not they're being told to. So I guess the calculation here on the part of the Speaker is, do I create bigger rifts within my caucus? Managing a supermajority is challenging enough as it is. Do I want to just create more tension and ill will when it won't do any good? Or shall I just, you know, keep the powder dry, so to speak, and wait till we get further down the line? So it's an issue. Clearly what's not going to happen is we won't see the resolutions that said the power ends now. Sorry, Governor, you don't have any power. Those have been sent to the legislative equivalent of quarantine in the Rules Committee for the most part. So we will, I think, see something closer, as Nikki suggests, to some ability for the lawmakers to weigh in or at least be consulted. I think that's the frustration that they have felt because they were not in session and they, of course, could not be consulted when they were not in session and they can't call themselves into session.
Right. All right. Well, maybe Bob Morris is confused about the effectiveness of mask wearing because the Girl Scouts of America support mask wearing. Republicans in a House committee this week voted to make it harder for Libertarian Party candidates for Indiana governor and U.S. senator to get on the ballot. Legislation would impose signature requirements on Libertarians that major party candidates must already meet. Democrats and Republicans who want to run for U.S. Senator Governor must collect 4,500 signatures of registered voters, 500 from each congressional district, in order to get on the primary ballot. Doing so isn't easy. It requires time and, importantly, resources. Libertarians don't have primaries in Indiana. Instead, their candidates for those offices are chosen at their state party convention. Republican Representative Ethan Manning says Libertarian candidates should also meet the signature requirement.
I really just wanted to more closely align those party candidates for those statewide offices.
Democratic Representative Matt Pierce questions why.
A cynical person might think that this bill arrived because the Libertarians did extraordinarily well for what we might call a third party.
The 2020 Libertarian candidate for governor got more votes than any other such candidate in state history. And Eleni, should Libertarians have to meet the same threshold as Democrats and Republicans?
you know, what's really interesting about this is you have a governor who ran against a Democratic candidate who had no resources, was barely on television at all, and you had a Libertarian who had no TV to speak of either. He had a very popular, Governor Holcomb had a very popular presidential candidate on his ballot, and yet he barely got over 50% of the vote. And this is the reaction. Their fear is that too many of the Republicans are, too many people who would ordinarily vote Republican are more comfortable as Libertarians, whether they're Trumpets or whatever they are, they're more comfortable voting Libertarian. So the first response of the Republican Party is, okay, well, let's keep them off the ballot. And, you know, and if they could think of a creative way to keep Democrats off the ballot, they'd do that too, because what they want is one party rule. You know, Democrats and Republicans both have the resources to qualify for the ballot. Qualifying for the ballot, having done it several times, is a pain in the neck. It is a very difficult process to do and to do it correctly. And the mistake, if you make it, can be catastrophic. So I understand that the Democrats and the Republicans have the resources. I don't think the Libertarians do. And I think they need a voice and we ought to just leave it alone.
Mike O'Brien, Representative Cherish Pryor in that committee hearing said, you know, this bill wants to treat Libertarians like the major party candidates, but doesn't give them anything. It doesn't treat them like major parties in the rest of the way that state law does. Is this really a fair, is this bill really fair?
That's a good point. I'm for that, too. One, I don't think Republicans want one-party control. We enjoy it, but we were also voted it by Hoosier voters. So, I mean, so
well, in
well, we won one-party control in a Democrat-drawn maps, so that's worth noting.
But the last time,
to Cherish Pryor's point, that's a good point, and it is a high bar to become a major party in the state of Indiana. That means you elect precinct committeemen. It means you have county chairman, a state committee. You have to staff polling locations and have there's a lot that goes into that. The last time Libertarians were close to that was in 2010 when Charlie White was having all kinds of trouble down the stretch in the general election. Voters and the conservative voters didn't go to Democrats. They went to the Libertarian who threatened to hit that threshold. And the Libertarian Party in Indiana threatened to sue them if they did because they didn't want to do all of that. The Libertarian Party in Indiana has never proven to me that they want to be anything other than a distant third voice. And not have to do that heavy lifting that's required of a major party. Now, I think Ethan Mania, the timing and the proximity of Rainwater performing the way he did, is that's a legitimate question. What's not legitimate is being in a state that allows anyone who wants to run statewide to allow them to do it. There's states like that, and they have hundreds of people run for president every year because all they have to do is sign their name. So and Ann's right. It's a pain in the butt. I stood outside of Walmart and gone door to door to get signatures up to the deadline to get candidates on the ballot in the primary. And it is a big threshold. And it should be. If you're going to run for the U.S. Senate or governor, you need to have prove you have a legitimate organization and support behind you.
Nikki Kelly, in terms of that idea of giving the Libertarians something in return for making them meet this threshold, we'll see if the bill comes up on the House floor. But if it does, Representative Kurt Nisely has a couple of amendments. But one of them would go a little further in terms of giving Libertarians something, would it not?
Yeah, I mean, basically it recognizes, hey, they're going to have to do more to get on the ballot. So it would give them a voting position on the Indiana Election Commission and on local county election boards. Obviously, they'd just be one of however many. They wouldn't have any control or anything like that. But you know what they say about having the seat at the table is the start.
And then John Schwanis, to point Mike O'Brien just made, even if I'm not here to say why Representative Ethan Manning brought this bill, but does the timing of it work against him?
I think I don't know if it works against him. It does fuel the skeptics such as Matt Pierce, whom you quoted in the introduction there. It gives them fuel to point to this and at least raise their eyebrows or raise questions about the timing. I don't think it's so much about a fear on the part of Republicans of losing the governor's office, because as Ann pointed out, even, you know, she says, well, the gubernatorial candidate, Eric Holcomb, got only barely 50%. But another way to look at that, you can cut the numbers any number of ways. And another way to look at it is he got more votes than anybody who's ever appeared on any statewide ballot in the state of Indiana since its founding in 1816. So you could also say he had a great showing in this election. But what I think maybe has not been addressed is that in a third of Indiana's counties, you had the Libertarian candidate, Donald Rainwater, who finished second to Eric Holcomb, beating the Democratic nominee, Woody Myers, which potentially, one could surmise, has some ripple effect in terms of other races on the ballot, legislative races, other races that where you have somebody driven to the polling place because of an interest in the gubernatorial candidate, and then maybe that would trickle down. Yeah. I think that, if anything, is more of the strategic concern here than the loss of the governor's office.
All right. Well, time now, now for viewer.
Donald Trump isn't on the ballot, that's a different story next time around.
Yeah, we'll see. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Libertarian governor and U.S. Senate candidates have to get 4,500 voter signatures to get on the ballot, just like Democrat and Republican candidates do? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you if you thought Governor Holcomb made the right call to shut down state government buildings out of concern for protests, even though those protests never materialized. 82% of you say, yeah, he made the right call, and just 18% said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Senate lawmakers are weighing a bill that would significantly shift the balance of appointments to the State Board of Education from the governor to the legislature. Currently, there are 11 members on the state board. One is the Secretary of Education, now appointed by the governor. The governor also appoints 8 other members to the board, while the Speaker of the House and the Senate President Pro Tem get one appointment each. Under Republican Senator Jeff Ross's bill, the governor would now appoint only 6 members of the board, including the Secretary of Education, while the Speaker and Senate leader would appoint 5 members. The measure would also require at least 2 members of the state board to be business owners or CEOs. Rotz says his bill isn't aimed at Governor Holcomb. Rather, he says it's about the future and making the board less lopsided. John Schwanes, how much do you think Holcomb pushes back on this?
I think he has grounds to push back, or an argument, a compelling argument to make if he wants to push back. All he would need to do is say, hey, let's think about the recent past. Not too many sessions ago, the reason that we went from an elected statewide position overseeing Department of Education, K through 12 education in Indiana, which was an elective post as state superintendent of public instruction, ostensibly the reason we did away with that is because Hoosier voters, they said, we elect the governor. We think he or she should be accountable for what happens with K through 12 education, that he or she should direct reform efforts and you know, be the that's where the buck stops. Now, I think the governor could argue this runs totally counter to that. Yeah, you may have an appointed secretary that is there to do arguably the governor's bidding, or at least advance the governor's agenda. But now you take away the governor's clout as manifested on the Board of Education. So it seems to me it would run totally counter to what was just done a year or so back.
Nikki Kelly, is perhaps the biggest thing working against this bill the fact that, are we really going to change things with the state board again?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like just a few years ago when we first gave the legislature, you know, their role in the appointees. And so then to basically give them even more. And I do want to point out that even though the governor had the majority of the appointments, he is limited by the number of people from the same party that can be on that board. So it's not like he can stock it with 8 Republicans. So, I mean, there already are sort of safeguards within.
And just wait until he has to put Libertarians on there as well. That
technically, he could put them on right now. Mike O'Brien, should the legislature be giving itself more of a voice on the State Board of Education? Is that the right course for education policy?
I agree with John. I mean, the whole point here was to consolidate the administration of education policy that is in large part set by the legislature to the governor, because that's who people when they vote hold to account when it comes to how schools are performing and how the state of education in Indiana. Now, the legislature, if they don't like how that's being administered, that's their role. It is to pass laws that the administration has to then go see into effect and administer. And before, again, to John's point, we had this other separate person that would that would go there, but no one was really conscious of that they were even voting for, other than just a select few who were probably teachers and people who were very tuned into education policy in Indiana. So that was the point from the beginning. The legislature has a huge role in that, obviously, with funding and policy setting.
And Delaney, Jeff Roth says this is not about Governor Eric Holcomb. It is about looking into the future. Are you buying that?
No, I'm not buying it. We've had a decision made in this state that the governor is responsible for education, K through 12. Okay, it's made. I have a better idea. Rather than quarreling over who should be appointed to the State Board of Education, we ought to abolish it. We ought to abolish it. It's the governor who enacts this policy through his hand-chosen superintendent. And anything else clutters it up and allows people to deflect blame other places. The governor's accountable through K through 12 education. The governor ought to be implementing it through his hand-chosen superintendent, and the legislature ought to just simply pass whatever bills it needs to and stay out of the Board of Education is irrelevant.
Wow. That's a good point.
A Senate bill advancing this week would remove protections for state-regulated wetlands in Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports it passed out of committee by an 8-3 vote.
Supporters of the bill say the state's unnecessary wetland regulations have driven up home prices and caused headaches for farmers. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management opposes the bill. Aaron Morehouse with IDEM says the state has already lost about 85% of its wetlands, which play an important role in Indiana.
Flood reduction, water storage, water quality, and wildlife habitats. Wetlands also absorb snowmelt and seasonal rain, replenish groundwater.
There are some federal laws that regulate pollution in wetlands, but IDEM says because the Trump administration changed the Waters of the United States rule, now the majority of wetlands in Indiana aren't regulated under the rule.
Nikki Kelly, Indiana builders have increasingly significant power in the General Assembly, so what are the chances this bill passes?
I think it's fair to say it has a good chance. It'll be tight, though. There was an amendment on the floor just the other day, and several Republicans joined Democrats on that. I find the bill fascinating. I've seen a lot of comments about how we need a balance between, you know, protecting the environment and hindering development. But I mean, this bill doesn't have any balance. It's just completely, you know, a free for all.
John Schwanes, to that point, that was exactly the point that Republican Senator Sue Glick brought up on the Senate floor on that vote on the amendment that would have sent this bill to a summer study committee that was ultimately defeated, which was, you know, this bill doesn't try to find a balance. Let's take the time and try to find that. Do you think that's where this is headed?
I don't know. There seems to be a lot of enthusiasm by backers of the bill to push it through right now for the reasons that have been stated. I'm going to go out on a limb here, though. Now, granted, my crystal ball is often cracked and foggy, but I would not be surprised that if this were passed, that the governor would do something he's done only on extremely rare occasion and consider vetoing the bill. Because this is a governor, keep in mind, who has really, he has his pillars that are the basis of his administration. One of them, more or less, is the preservation of quality of life through robust park properties and conservation and trails linking this, the notion that we can attract businesses and people to our state with the quality of our natural wonders. And I think he could argue that it's not well thought out, and it flies in the face of the message he has been putting forth now since he became governor. And as he did with sort of the tenant rights bill at the end of last session, I could see this being something that gets the veto pen.
All right. Well, we'll probably be talking more about that bill as it advances through the process. But finally, speaking of bills that passed the Senate this week, one would make popcorn the official snack of Indiana. Now, Mike O'Brien, before getting into the issue of whether or not we should be passing a bill that makes popcorn the state snack of Indiana, can you think of a better choice?
There's time for everything, Brandon. We can say multitudes here. We can do all kinds of things in the General Assembly. Big, important things and little things like passing the state snack. No, I don't think it'd kill Indiana to have a vegetable on there, though.
Well, that's health initiatives all around. And Delaney, a better choice than popcorn?
Oh, a better choice would be dealing with the pandemic. For goodness sake, this sends a terrible message. And in addition to this one, they want to regulate lemonade stands. Now, come on.
They
want to deregulate lemonade stands. Deregulate lemonade stands.
All the important issues, while Rome is burning, they sit there fiddling, and that's what they're doing, fiddling around.
John Schwannis, better than popcorn?
Well, I won't be the judge of that, but there are some prominent candy manufacturers in the state of Indiana
They might have something to say. Nikki, very quickly, better than popcorn, or is popcorn the choice?
I'm going with candy corn, just so I can be controversial.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask because in reality they work, and join us next time because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.